The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events.
When we factor in where we're at as a country and the context of how we price all of our assets, for the dollar, what course is it on? Is this the last chapter? And is it characterized by bang? Again, a la violent regime change, or a whimper, where the evolutionary process just leads us towards greater and greater irrelevance? Time will tell.
Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. Wow, it's good to have you back. You were with your dad and your mom and family over in Europe, and fortunately you sent the tape for the listeners to hear a couple of weeks ago, you and your dad talking, and I saw last night, Dave, the pictures of where you recorded that program on the, what was it, the Adriatic?
Well, we were in Umbria when we recorded that, and just looking out over the countryside, sitting right above a series of Etruscan caves, you know, so we're talking about, you know, places where people stored things and hid things thousands of years ago. It was a pretty remarkable trip.
Well, and you ended that trip with a triathlon, like everybody does. You know, when they take a relaxing vacation, the last thing they want to do, the first thing you want to do, actually, is go ahead and run a race that's 70-some-odd miles.
Now, I'm fairly certain that in 24 hours, I was able to crank enough cortisol through my body to eliminate all the benefits of several weeks of vacation. So.
Yeah, but you were telling me a story. You and I were talking last night about playing the long game and how important it is not to burn out early if you're actually playing the long game. And, you know, you're the author of the book Legacy, which is all about long game. But your race taught you something, didn't it?
Yeah, it did. It did. And I'm reminded of it because there's parallel lessons here. If you're an options trader, you're focused on what happens in the next 2 seconds or 2 days. Maybe if you're a long game thinker in the options market, it's 2 weeks.
Right.
But that's your perspective. And the longer term perspective may incorporate years or decades.
If you're Warren Buffett, it's a lifetime or generations of lifetime.
Yeah, and so I think there is that option of thinking in very short terms, and it makes you into a person who's making very different decisions.
Right.
And so to me, I think my preference is for the long game. And when you're racing, you certainly have to keep that in mind.
Well, you said your race, your swim, okay, a triathlon. And fortunately, I've gotten a chance to do this once, you know, a half Ironman with you. You've sort of got addicted to it. I moved away from it after doing one. But you said your swim was the fastest you've had. It's a personal record. They're in Austria.
That's right. So we were in Austria, Zellamsee, Austria, and it was my fastest swim ever.
Right.
The most beautiful bike ride I've ever been on.
Yeah, and it was a fast bike ride, too. Well, I mean, it was close to probably a record bike ride for you, too, at least personal.
Well, I mean, I've actually had better races, but it was a solid. It was a solid effort given the terrain.
But you pushed, and you put everything into the first two legs, because you told me the run was misery.
Oh, the run was really tough. Right. It was really tough.
And that's a half marathon distance, the run just alone.
That's right. So usually the first mile is no fun, just because you're transitioning off of kind of thick legs and the bike ride, 56 miles on the bike.
Yeah.
And this time it was like mile 7 before my legs started feeling natural again. Because, I mean, I'm, you know, lactic acid from the ride. We had this pitch that went from 4.5% to 8 to 9%, and then ended in the small mountain town, Deenton, at about a 14.4%
grade. This is the bike you're talking.
That's right. Yeah. That's the grade on the bike. And then I pushed it downhill pretty hard, and it just didn't leave anything in the tank. So again, just kind of a lesson. You have to take a measured pace in all things in life. And when you don't, there's pain.
Right.
And then all of a sudden, these other lessons of, you know, I am suffering in the first 7 miles here, ready to quit. And I'm finding all of these weird emotional outlays. Like I'm thinking about what should have gone right on this trip, and you know, my wife should have done that. Or I mean, amazingly
right.
irrational.
Right. You start finding fault because you're
That's
in pain.
Right. Oh, totally.
Right.
And it was interesting to sort of see it, to experience it, to move past it, then reflect on it and say, wow, this is amazing. I set myself up for a very difficult thing because I wasn't playing the long game. I put out too much effort up front. And then all of a sudden I have to deal with this warped and twisted emotional response to pain.
Right.
And anyways, it's just, I love the lessons learned in the context of struggle. And I'm reminded that so many things in life, so many opportunities that we have to walk through some version of suffering. And some people, it's far more significant and far more acute, the loss of a loved one or what have you. These are all opportunities for us to reflect, to grow. And again, I think what we're overwhelmed by in the minute, in the day, if we have a longer term perspective, all of a sudden it doesn't matter quite as much.
Well, and the word is expectations as well. Part of the reason you were experiencing the pain and getting angry at things you normally wouldn't on that run.
Totally irrational.
Is because you had expectations that were not being met. And we see that in the investment world. Okay. When we talk to people who, I'll give you an example, when Bitcoin exploded, that all of a sudden became the new norm for people. It's like, well, you know, I'd like to see my 1,000 go to 20,000. Well, that can't be an expectation. That's not a long-term type of thing. Another thing, though, let's transfer it over to what we've been seeing with Mario Draghi and the central bankers. But I'm going to just single out Mario Draghi because this week, he's probably going to continue to give gifts that create unnatural expectations in the market. And that is just free money, quantitative easing, buying every bond out there until they're negative rates.
It was really interesting being in Italy as the government's collapsing and reflecting on the Italian head of the European Central Bank, who was a former Goldman Sachs guy. He's now retiring, and Christine Lagarde is coming on board quickly. So this is one of his last meetings. The ECB meets Wednesday, Thursday this week. Draghi's always delivered the goods. And then, of course, we have next week the Fed meets in the committee. At this point, the Federal Reserve Committee is divided on cutting rates. Should they cut them at all? Should it be 25 or 50 basis points? And it's a really fascinating environment because if there's one thing I'm grateful for at this point, it's how the markets have all these things figured out. You know, you've heard of the efficient market hypothesis, where we know what's going to happen and it's all priced in. There's no such thing as surprise in the markets today. And I'm grateful for that. I'm grateful that we have it all figured out.
And the problem is the market is based on surprise. Okay. That's what new information is. But
I apologize for my sarcasm, but the issues are many because you've got German industrial production, which is falling, and it fell more than expected in July. If you look at German GDP, and Germany is the engine of growth in Europe, this is why it matters so much. If you look at German GDP versus the ECB assets, so the European Central Bank assets, there should have been lift in the German economy from all the quantitative easing that's happened there, but it hasn't helped.
Right.
It hasn't happened. So you've got the muscular moves by the ECB, and that's running alongside German GDP, even as it's running out of gas, as it's continuing to slow. And so the German economy remains weak. You've got low rates and massive liquidity from the central bank there sloshing around. And despite the lack of economic impact, there's this expectation that Draghi is going to go out of office with this hot announcement. Mm-hmm. Deeper cuts with rates, more bond buying. It'll help make a smooth transition as he leaves the post. Again, because remember, Lagarde's taking his place shortly. And, you know, of course, we all reflect, what kind of legacy does he want to leave? He definitely wants to go out on a solid note.
Well, thinking this through, normalization of rates, they've talked about that now for, you know, 10 years. That is raising rates back to what would be a normal economy. But instead, you know, going back to your race, when you push too hard, too long, you're going to lose somewhere in the end. And have we done that? Has the Draghi influence and the Bernanke and the Yellen influence and now the Powell influence, Bank of Japan, I mean, we can go ahead and talk about all the central banks. They've been absolutely applying every bit of energy that they possibly can, emergency type of energy. There's no way to normalize. In fact, at this point, is there any way to go anything but negative rates?
Yeah, and I love that idea that there's energy use and you're just making a decision as to when and how to spend and use that energy.
Right.
And, you know, in a race, you can supplement and fuel as you go. But even your body has limits in terms of what it can take in a given period of time. And if you take in too much energy, like you want to transfer fuel to energy, you can actually create problems by adding too much fuel to create the energy that you desire.
Well, and there's something that happens in a race. When you stop getting enough oxygen and fuel, you go anaerobic. And anaerobic you can use for just a little while, but I'm wondering, are we seeing the exhaustion of Germany, which really does lead Europe? Are we seeing that we can't normalize rates, but actually what we're going to have is deeper and deeper negative rates?
Yeah, and I mean, we've talked about that with the IMF paper saying deep, deep negative rates are a real possibility, and we're told that they can be far more negative in nominal terms than previously imagined. That's the academic argument.
Right.
As we discussed a few weeks ago, this is, I think, one of the contributing factors to a slowing European economy. When you start lowering rates, you know, you've got banks that play this vital role in stimulating economic activity. What they do is they take in deposits and they put out loans. This is called intermediation. It's the process whereby deposits come in, loans go out, and those loans are to accommodate consumption or investment by small businesses, other things like that. And this is what we discussed a few weeks ago within the European banking community. And the depositors have the memory of the bail-ins. So we go back to Cyprus and Greece, and now you've got the real-time interpretation of bail-ins via negative rates, because that's essentially what it is. And that's what Carmen talked about last week when we replayed that, is it's just another form of theft or pickpocketing, as she described it. Bank depositors have slowed the flow of money into the banking system, and that has slowed the quantity of small loans out of the bank as well. So this low-rate environment is crippling the normal intermediation process that banks have, and yet we don't see the dots being connected by academics. When we were in Italy, we spoke to a number of people about real estate lending, and at present in Italy, it's virtually non-existent. So you've got very low volumes of transactions, people buying homes and selling homes, because it all has to be cash transactions, fully paid up. It definitely impacts the volume of sales.
Well, sure. Bank intermediation. Okay. I read something yesterday about how the negative rates have actually caused the zombification of banks. Okay. So it's creating the living dead. That's what a zombie is, right? It's a dead body that comes to life, but it really has no life in it.
Well, that's actually what Larry Summers, which you read yesterday, Larry Summers, when he was at Jackson Hole, he was saying, look, this is the reality. You guys think this is going to work, but keep in mind, we are doing sort of the zombification of the banking arena. And I don't think this is going to turn out quite the way you want it to. So even Larry Summers is now saying, look, low rates, negative rates, deeply negative rates, you're playing a very dangerous game.
So they've broken the very thing that stimulated the economy in the past.
Exactly. So, I mean, the role of finance within the economy is a pretty big deal. The role of banking within an economy is a big deal. And when bank intermediation is broken, which it is in Europe, keep in mind, if we do the same thing, negative rates brought here to the U.S., likely to cause the same issue. You already see it in terms of velocity. We did mention this a few weeks back. Velocity is the rate at which a dollar or any currency unit turns over in an economy. And it's at such a low level on both sides of the pond, both sides of the Atlantic. You get central bank academics, they're not connecting the dots of cause and effect.
Right.
And they can't. And you might ask, why can't they? And I think this is back to this issue of the strategies that they're suggesting and employing are necessary, given the amount of leverage that exists in the financial system. And I'm not saying necessary as in justifiable, but there is a logical sequence. When you have too much debt in the system, you have to control the variables that you can control.
Okay, but now we get a chance to peek behind the curtain, because next week, okay, the Fed, they're going to announce whether they're going to be lowering, raising, or keeping interest rates the same. The peek behind the curtain is this. We've got a stock market that's near all-time highs.
2% from all
times. They're telling us the economy is great. So the only excuse for lowering rates would normally be that we need to stimulate the economy. Is there another reason at this point? Is that what you're saying?
I think it's a thin, thin argument. I mean, it's tough for the Fed, I think, to do anything when you've got the S&P 2% from all-time highs, employment officially sits about 3.7%. And imagine if we're in the next week or so at all-time highs, and they're cutting rates? I think history is going to record that as folly, and it's going to be interpreted by future generations as in a fairly unforgiving way.
And it's not just the stock market. I mean, employment, that's another thing that the Federal Reserve really looks at, and a lot of times they'll use high unemployment as a reason to lower rates. What do they do when it's low unemployment?
Right. So you've got the official numbers at 3.7. Additionally, you had August ADP numbers, which were strong. You had July factory orders, which were stronger than expected. I guess what we're saying is this is not a backdrop that justifies or says that Fed intervention is needed right
now. Is it the global economy?
Well, sure. I mean,
are we trying to save the globe?
That's what everyone will point to, is uncertainty. All right. So we got to accommodate because of the uncertainty in the market. Where's the uncertainty tied to? Yes, the global economy is ugly. Yes, that includes the powerhouses in Europe and Asia. Yes, there is a broad swath of Latin America, which struggling. It's struggling now just to avoid recession. Then, of course, we've got the disaster stories of Venezuela and Argentina, which are already in recession. But on a relative basis, the U.S. economy looks better. It looks better than all of them. And I think this is something of a sticking point for the committee. Why you have dissent is the rest of the world looks pretty ugly. The U.S. doesn't really look that bad. I mean, our manufacturing PMIs, purchasing manager indexes, those are weak. They're at 2009 levels. That's nothing to write home about. But your service PMIs, they're okay. Again, how does it make sense to be lowering rates at all? I mean, I guess you could lean on David Rosenberg, who would be the first to say earnings have been under pressure, corporate earnings. And he would argue that we're already in an earnings recession. So looking under the hood of corporate America, things have been deteriorating. So you've got the broader economy, not so bad. You've got, you know, retail sales, things of this, that even with a decline in home purchases and auto purchases, retail sales were pretty decent recently. But you look under the hood of corporate America, Dave Rosenberg says earnings have been in decline. We don't like what we see for the third quarter. And the earnings recession is already here. So maybe that's it. Maybe that's what they're responding to.
You know, sometimes the market can be a little bit like a spoiled child, the stock market. And you remember the tantrum a few years back when the Fed said, okay, so things are starting to look good. We're going to go ahead and raise rates. I think it was just a quarter of a point.
The taper tantrum.
Yeah, the taper tantrum. That's exactly right. The market started falling hundreds of points instantly. And, of course, they reversed course.
Well, back to your point about expectations being so key. There's a large expectation from market participants that the Fed do something. Now, why now? I don't know, but do something. And we know from experience that the market throws its tantrums when it doesn't get what it wants.
Yeah, but we're getting near the top. I mean, price earnings ratio, anytime it's above 20, you've got to be nervous. And we're at what, 29, 30, right in that area?
Well, again, we're jumping from a regular standard issue price earnings ratio closer to 20 versus the Shiller PE. Mm-hmm. So the Shiller PE, or what they call the cyclically adjusted price earnings multiple, you take 10 years and take out some of the volatility, that's at 29. Mm. And it's at the top end of the range. It's not at a record. The record was back in 2000, but stock market capitalization to GDP, what we call the Buffett ratio, that's at 142%. That is at the top end of the range. And your price to sales, looking at that as a valuation metric, that's at an all-time record high.
I do have a question, though. All right. I have often from clients been asked, what if the Fed becomes political? Now, that's sort of tongue-in-cheek anyway, because the Fed almost always is political. They try to act like they're unique and unattached to the political system. But actually, guys involved with the Fed make political statements. And Dudley, I'm thinking of Dudley.
The distinction is between two words, remain and appear, because you could say, well, we're supposed to remain objective. The reality is you're supposed to appear objective.
It's all perception.
You're supposed to appear objective. One more thing before we move past valuations, because this is really about timing and not valuations, but I think it's complementary. You got to remember September to October is that period of time where you're getting to the end of the six bad months and you're moving towards the six good months of the year.
Mm.
Just looking at the Stock Trader's Almanac, you know, six bad months, six good months. There's a time that you want to be in, time that you don't want to be in. If you're trading on an annual basis, there's a way to manage an account that way. There's some weaknesses to doing it that way. But the point being, we've had historically a number of our major market dislocations in that September to October timeframe. So it's really important that the market holds together here and now. I mean, you know, we can talk 2020 elections and we can talk Bill Dudley, I'd love to, but the idea that we get very far down the road, we need to get past September and October without a major market dislocation. Otherwise, this is a season of natural stress and strain.
Do you remember a few years ago, we looked at how many Democrats are in the Federal Reserve, and it was over 90% of the Federal Reserve was Democrat.
Now, it has nothing to do with their hiring policy.
Yeah. Well, here's my question. Okay, let's say you don't like Trump, and let's say for the good of everyone in the world, you think that maybe Trump shouldn't be president in 2020. What do you do if you're at the Fed?
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm glad that Bill Dudley is no longer at the Fed.
Right.
And I know
still an influencer, though.
Well, he is. Yeah. He is. He was head of the New York Fed from 2009 to 2018. And he's going to be talking at the next Grants Conference.
You're going to that.
Next month, of course.
Yeah.
And I wonder if Dudley's comments he made recently to Bloomberg, I couldn't believe it. I wonder if his comments advocating that the Fed interfere in the 2020 election.
No more the Russians. No more the Russians.
Yeah,
now the Fed.
Yeah. Isn't that interesting how it's wrong if it's the Reds, but if it's the Feds, it's just fine. While we live in an interesting world.
Well.
Now, Bloomberg quoted him late August saying, there's even an argument that the election itself falls within the Fed's purview. After all, Trump's election arguably presents a threat to the U.S. and global economy, to the Fed's independence, and its ability to achieve its employment and inflation objectives. If the goal of monetary policy is to achieve the best long-term economic outcome, then Fed officials should consider how their decisions will affect the political outcome of 2020.
Hint.
Well, I mean, granted, he's no longer at the Fed. He can say whatever he wants, but you're right, he is an influencer. And just as a reminder, Dudley was one of the Goldman transplants into the Fed. He served as New York Fed president that tenure, 2009 to 2018. And I listen to those words, and it sounds reasonably nonpartisan,
don't you think? It was just an objective warning to make sure you stay objective.
Because we care about the global economy and we care about monetary policy effectiveness.
Right. Well, I do wonder. I mean, I have wondered and clients have wondered, are they going to pull the rug out from under Trump? You and I have talked about this on the commentary.
Yeah,
it is a possibility.
If there's sympathetic quarters within the Fed to Bill's thinking, Mr. Dudley's thinking, the markets suffer. And, you know, can allow Trump to take the brunt of the financial market deterioration, and the social and political backlash there in the 2020 election. On the other hand, you have Powell, who's talking about extending the business cycle.
Mm-hmm.
And so what does that imply? It implies activism consistent with our current age. It implies rate cuts. It implies market support on any major correction. It implies, you know, the Powell put, so to say. It implies that downside risk in extremis, he's got it covered.
You know, recently, my son and I watched the movie Free Solo. I think you said you had just seen it, too. But the thing about Free Solo, this was, what was he climbing? Al Capitan?
That's right out in Yosemite.
Yeah, and it had never been...
Free Solo, in other words, climbing it without ropes.
Yeah, which means, you know, if you make a mistake, it's a really, really long fall. You have time to think about it, actually, I think, you know, before you hit the ground. But how do you manage money in an environment where... if you just miss one handhold,
right,
you fall long enough that you have time to think about the complete destruction of the economy. Yet, how do you manage money? I mean, we've got clients flying in this week, meeting with Doug and Lila and, you know, you and Robert. And the question's going to come up. How do you manage money in such a dangerous environment?
And we're not taking the risks that the Fed is.
Okay.
Because the system itself is precariously perched on some cliff edge. I mean, that's the reality. We've gotten so above our heads in terms of the kind of leverage that we have in the financial markets that these guys with PhDs can pretend to have it figured out. But as we talked to William White years ago at the Bank of International Settlements, it's art, not science. And
right.
We get it more wrong than right. And yet they've conveyed or created this idea that it's just the numbers and it's just science and it's just probabilities and we've just got it.
So you're going to use ropes. Thank you very much. Ropes and what is it? Carabiners and the things that actually would keep you from the long fall.
Well, for us managing in this environment, it's not that it's not without challenge because you've got global financial conditions which are frail. You've got the U.S. financial markets contrast that financial markets between U.S. economic metrics, but U.S. financial market metrics, they're pricey. U.S. economic metrics look not so bad, particularly in contrast to the global metrics, which are abysmal. And then always waiting in the wings, you've got the central bank community defending what is a completely over-leveraged financial system. Mm-hmm. So if you see any price volatility, the fear is that price volatility morphs into liquidity concerns for particular entities, financial market entities, and then solvency concerns. Replay of 2008, 2009. And so as an asset manager, you've got the interventionist X factor, which is real. There's money that can flow from the Fed, and it can also flow from the Treasury. If you're talking about fiscal intervention.
There are still tools, is what you're saying.
There's announcements that can be made. But even then, it's up to the market to buy in, to buy it, to believe that what is being said and what is being done will be effective.
Well, and they've been trained to do so. I mean, let's face it, the market doesn't think for itself anymore. More and more, when I'm talking to somebody, especially somebody new who's not worked with us before, they show us their assets, you know, their 401k, what have you. And I'll say, okay, what are you invested in? Tell me, stocks, bonds, what have you. They have no idea.
And I think one of the things that is a differentiator here is the age of the person in question. Because if you had money invested in 2008, in 2009, you may have confidence in the system, but it's not without doubts. Because you have a muscle memory and it's a pain memory. I don't want to do this again. I had a nest egg and that nest egg got cut in half in 2008 and 2009. I can't do that again. So age does have a bearing because that would mean that you went through the turmoil and the travails of the global financial crisis.
Well, money managers as well. I mean, a lot of these money managers were not there in 2008.
Well, I think that is an absolutely critical point to make is the majority of asset managers today had not graduated from college and had zero experience coming through the global financial crisis. I mean, this is only 10 years ago.
Right.
But the majority of asset managers today are sub 40, even in their late 20s, early 30s. They were not around. They have no exposure. All they know is, look, if there's a problem, the Fed intervenes.
You don't see much gray hair. You do, however, this week. Doug's coming in. You've got a little bit coming in. I'm sorry. You guys have been through a few of these. You know?
I do not. I
talk to Deeds.
I will not use Grecian formula ever.
Well, I talked to Jim Deeds yesterday. 87 years young. This guy is still actively engaged in watching the market, but he's completely dismayed because he looks at money management these days. And what I was saying, many of the clients that I talked to knew, don't really know what they're coming out of because these funds now have new names like the 20-year fund or the 30-year fund or they'll put the date of the retirement on the fund. And there's just an automatic way that you manage that kind of money. But you ask what the mix would be. Are you actually managing? Are you buying and selling stocks based on certain company attributes? They're not. And that really is the market. You said the market has to buy it. But if the market's just buying everything, when do they panic?
But I think what I'm focusing on too is the market has to buy that interventionist X factor. When you have an announcement from the Fed or from the ECB or from the Bank of Japan, there is still this opportunity for the participant to say, is this believable? Is it not? Because in moments of crisis, people feel more. People think less, and they tend to defer to authority or lean on professionals, particularly if their messaging and the solutions that are proffered are convincingly communicated. And the effective communication is perhaps the greatest tool that the central bank community has. What they can and can't do in real interventionist terms, it still hinges on the public's validation of the strategies, and it comes down to this one word, belief. Belief that those strategies are adequate. So the hinging and holding things together, or the unhinging process, one way or the other, is a purely psychological one.
Well, and somebody must be seeing something, because the dollar is still strong, and gold has been putting on more and more and more gains. I mean, yeah, it's come back a few dollars here in the last few days, but look at the last couple of years.
I want to go back to a comment we made earlier about just having some perspective, and how if you're trading options, sometimes you forget the big picture. How's this for big picture? Warren Buffett versus a 1 ounce gold coin. Warren Buffett versus a 1 ounce gold coin. 1999 to the year 2019, a 20-year stretch. And as Berkshire Hathaway is weighed in the balance, it is found wanting.
Huh.
Gold is up 487%. Berkshire Hathaway, 386%. The best management that money can buy, the smartest investor maybe known to man, at least in this generation, perhaps the most influential way to invest, value investing, long-term investing.
He's being beaten by a little silly 1 ounce coin.
Gold coin.
Yeah.
Now, so would you say it's noteworthy that the dollar is strong? The markets have held together. They're a few percentage points below all-time highs. We're talking NASDAQ, S&P 500, Dow. And here we have gold last week reaches 1558, 1,558. Silver is nearly 20 bucks. That was last week, not this week. And what we've referenced on the commentary is this gradual and quiet move of gold off the lows of late 2015, December 2015, at $1,050 an ounce. And we've described how the movement in metals, it's really been eclipsed in terms of the market awareness of this. It's been eclipsed by the strength in the stock market.
Mm-hmm.
And it's basically given us a stealth bull market in precious metals.
Isn't that how all the big bull markets start, though? Is in a stealthy, quiet way.
Yeah.
That's an early phase.
It is. And so the activity of the last 90 days is shining more of a spotlight on the metals. Silver confirms the move higher here with its most recent move. And the confirmation of a longer-term trend in the metals, I think this began with gold surpassing and holding above that 1365 to 1380 range. And then, as I mentioned, silver confirms on the upside again. You've got that ratio shrinking from the mid-90s to the low 80s. Very constructive, very constructive. And it would be constructive, too, to see the 1500 level on gold hold. Will it? Maybe it does, maybe it doesn't. I think we could go back to that 1365 range and still be in a very good place, 1365 to 1380. I'm not saying that we will go there. I'm just saying that a correction is in order. A cooling off is not a bad idea. And I'll tell you, it's a really tough call. I want to own gold now, and I'm not selling it or trading out of it on the basis of potential volatility. This is very short term. You look at the next couple of weeks, it's a tough call. You've got central banks that are doing their thing. The next 2 weeks are going to be very interesting between the ECB and the Fed. And what we have seen is a move higher. We've seen a move higher, you know, as a function of Fed activity, central bank activity, move higher in terms of gold prices.
So the trend is intact. What you're saying is, you know, maybe buying when you do see a drop in the metal, that would be wise.
So that really big picture of, you know, starting at under $300 an ounce and moving to now $1,500 with an interim high of $1,900 back in 2011, 2012, that long-term trend is still intact. There's some short-term gyrations. I guess what I'm saying is rather than chase prices, buying on pullbacks is sensible. Mm-hmm. We've actually have one now. Silver's now a dollar off its peak, $1.50 off its peak. And so the short-term guidance is, you know, patiently put money into the metals in the 17s is great for silver. Set the short-term guidance next to the long-term guidance, which is that we have re-engaged a multi-year uptrend in the metals.
Yeah, but it's not the American buyer. This is a worldwide phenomenon. You talk to an American and they have no interest in gold.
No, I think it's a function of the global economy. It's a function of the concerns that dysfunctional relationships are proliferating. It's a function of, you know, under the surface, concerns about consequences coming from the monetary policies already in play, and instilled those monetary policies yet to be announced. Obviously, this week, next week, between the ECB and the Fed. The bull market in metals is a function of the concerns relating to the gradual, maybe even the violent overthrow someday of King Dollar at some point. And I think it's also a function of yield, where you look at the interest rate market, and this goes back to the conversation we had with Dixilla a couple weeks ago. It's nearly $17 trillion in bonds with a negative nominal yield. And it's fascinating if you chart the quantity of bonds at negative yields with the price in gold. Both are moving in lockstep. So maybe it is a function of having no yield in the fixed income market where the price of gold is moving higher, tracking the quantity of negatively yielding paper.
So it looks like we're going to have more negative yielding paper. But the long-term trend, there are things you can do even within the metals as they rise. You were talking about silver looking attractive in the 17s. What's also attractive about silver right now is you can get 80 ounces roughly for an ounce of gold. And at some times, those silver prices get up to where 80 ounces would buy 2 ounces of gold.
Well, the way I look at it is buying silver at 17 is like buying gold at a 40 to 50% discount.
Mm.
You know, so 60 cents on the dollar is what you're paying for gold if you're buying silver today. And, you know, I think establishing reasonable cost basis, riding the long-term trend, that's an effective way of compounding wealth over multiple cycles. And gold illustrates that. We're near record levels in the S&P 500. We're not near record levels in gold. We're still $400 away from that. Mm-hmm. We're still over 100%, more than that, away from silver exceeding the old highs. Yet looking at gold, it has still outperformed stocks over the past two decades. Pick your indexes, as we were picking on Berkshire Hathaway a minute ago, but from the turn of the century, the NASDAQ is up roughly 60%. And the Dow is up 130%, not adjusted for inflation. And you may be the critic out there who says, wait, choose a different starting date for those returns. Okay, well, we can end up with different numbers. Even the critic, you got to explain why gold and silver have moved in this period of time, because they move on an emotional and psychological basis. There's a number of people in the system who are opting out of the system because they see problems with the system. And so why does the Dow gold ratio sit at half the level it did in the year 2000?
Right. And the Dow gold ratio is, you just basically take the price of the Dow and divide that by ounces of gold. And still, we're a long ways away from where we were in 2008.
Well, and I guess what I'm saying is that you've seen progress made in that ratio, and it implies something about there being a trend in place. Even though financial assets appear to be the most important thing to own in a portfolio, there's a number of people who would second guess that and have already positioned in metals, and you see it reflected in the ratio. Tell me what this implies. Tell me what this implies. This is even more powerful to me, at least this week, this month, and for 2019. TrimTab's investment research, they count August as the fifth month of this year in which insider selling has topped $10 billion. Okay, so get this. For August, that's an average of $600 million a day of insider stock sales. That's per day.
These are people who know what they're doing because they own shares of their own company.
Of course. And if you listen in to some of the earnings conference calls with the CEOs, whether it's in the tech space or whether it's in the consumer space, these guys are not particularly encouraged. And maybe they're a little concerned because of the tariffs and trade, and that creates uncertainty, and that's leading them to lower forward guidance. But I can tell you they are operating and taking personal action to protect their personal balance sheets. And you have to go back to 2006 and 2007 for those kinds of numbers, $600 million a day in insider stock sales. Mm. Again, TrimTab's put the numbers together. But I think when I look at the Dow gold ratio, when I look at insider selling, there's some signals here that don't matter for someone who's trading on a daily basis, who's looking at options trades, but absolutely matter and absolutely tell you what you need to know if you're concerned about a longer term or a bigger picture.
Dave, today marks the anniversary of September 11th, 2001. And you actually had a direct connection. You fortunately were not at the World Trade Center when that happened, but you had been recently before that.
I was at Morgan Stanley when the towers came down, having recently finished my training with the company in one of those towers. And from then to now, again, reflecting on the markets and reflecting on gold still, there's been a trend change. And the underlying factors driving financial market excess, they've increased. Those factors have increased. The excesses have increased. The debt levels we're willing to sustain at a private, corporate, at a governmental level, they've increased. They've multiplied. And now we're in the position, relative to our economy, relative to GDP, that in order to maintain our debts with the current level of economic activity we have, you have to manipulate rates to the lowest possible level. Mm. So this again, all of these things kind of fit tightly together. Controlling the rate of interest is a required path for the global central planners to prevent the wheels from coming off, as interest expense would blow up the equation. You got to think about that interest expense. We've more than doubled the national debt. And if you look at, again, corporate balance sheets and private balance sheets, the one factor that makes this doable, workable, manageable is that interest component, which means, yes, central banks have to be active heretofore. Leverage is at this scale, and it only makes sense at these numbers if you believe you can control the interest component. You know, But that move towards market management, what it's doing is it's shifting the buying habits of individuals. It's also shifting the buying habits of certain central banks, particularly emerging market central banks, and it's shifting them in the direction of gold.
You know, when you try to control too much, it goes out of hand. Remember Buchstaber, when he talked about a demon of our own design. The idea behind trying to control or manage risk oftentimes gets you into trouble. I also think of Tainter. Remember when we interviewed Tainter, the collapse of complex societies?
Joseph Tainter.
And, you know, his whole point on the collapse of societies, or even, you know, you have these catastrophic events like when the shuttle blew up. You have a million different working parts, and they're all under complete control, or you think, until one thing goes wrong. Aren't we seeing, like with the rise of gold right now, aren't we seeing the rise in gold paralleling the dramatic need to control everything?
Yeah, I think you could probably chart it. I'll have to figure out how to do that. Demand for the metals increasing seemingly in proportion to the measures taken to manage outcomes.
Right.
And I think anyone with a sense of history knows that the requirement to control, when it gets to the point where you must insert yourself into the equation and control an outcome, it implies that control has already been lost. Mm. It's a little bit like a parent, you know, when you raise your voice. When you've raised your voice, all you're doing is signaling that circumstances are already beyond your ability to influence. And now you're just desperately trying to rein them in and use what power you think you may still have to get a desired outcome. But response, how people respond to you, it still is tied to this view of what you do and what you say. I'm still going to make a judgment as to whether or not you're credible, right? So even if you raise your voice, is this credible? What you do, what money you spend, the way you would have, is this credible? There is a judgment. And this is, again, there's a psychological component here, which is kind of an unbound problem for the designers of these outcomes.
In a way, you have two worlds. You have the world of perception. And I have to admit, my perception is, you know, you talk about the changes since 2001, September 11. The changes have been remarkable, but probably the greatest change in the financial markets is the control from the central banks and the negative interest rates, this massive infusion. Yet at the same time, Dave, gold's risen sixfold.
Right. Yeah, six times from its lows in the early 2000s, that outpaces the S&P, NASDAQ, and Dow. And it should tell you something about the underlying tensions that exist in the financial markets. It should tell you about perception of a number of investors who would say, I don't like what's developing politically. I don't like what is deteriorating geopolitically. That ties into a conversation with Harold James. He wrote the book, The End of Globalization, in 2008. He was gathering his research from the decade that preceded it. Okay, so he's looking at the end of globalization dating back to 2000, 2001, 2002. He's not talking about because of the trade and tariff issues between Trump and Xi today. That is merely a symptom of what has been in deteriorating function for a long time now. So the political and geopolitical spheres, we have risks that are not yet accounted for in the S&P, in the NASDAQ, in the Dow. The markets don't adequately reflect it. And I think it's just important to recognize that. It's not a message, the message that gold is sending, and the lack of a message from the financial markets, it's just not a message that many investors have grasped, but I suspect that they're going to over the next few years. Again, the metals complex is higher for a reason. Gold stocks are up 40% year to date because of a reason. And a lot of it deals with this dysfunction in the system.
There was dysfunction in the system in 1969. Okay. We've talked about how long ago that feels, but actually that was the last time central banks were buying as much gold as they are right now. And I thought it was interesting, this meeting at Jackson Hole a couple of weeks ago. Look what Carney said about the dollar. It sounds like 1969.
That's right. It's about regime change. Mark Carney from the Bank of England, he'd love to scrap the international monetary system. He's highly critical of it being unipolar and as dollar-centric as it is. Again, it's rich, right? Coming from the Bank of England, maybe he's forgotten that we hold the baton that the British passed to us or we took from them.
Now he wants it back.
Yeah. So, I mean, yeah. you could say, is this an issue of nostalgic regret? Maybe they played their hand poorly in the 40s after the war. Or is it like a Brit at the snooker table? Have you ever played snooker? Where, you know, someone else's loss may be your gain.
Mm.
It's very British, very British.
Yeah, but what he's proposing is a currency to replace the dollar, a little bit like what Facebook proposed.
It could be the Libra, could be something else. I have a hard time imagining Facebook's Libra being allowed to supplant national currencies.
I do too.
But I mean, that is because of the political cost, not because there might not be some demand for it. But I think you can manage that demand and make it go away if you want to maintain the monopoly. And I can't think of a central bank that doesn't want that monopoly. In fact, coming from Italy, I think the Italian central bank is regretting having given that monopoly over and may, in fact, want it back someday.
When you had Barry Eichengreen on, he had written the book Exorbitant Privilege, and it was about the U.S. dollar being the world's reserve currency. And granted, the word fair or fairness is really not even fair to bring up in the program because nothing's ever fair, but it's really not equitable to the other countries that have to pay back their own debt. And we just print money to pay ours.
Well, and I think the academics have long argued for that more fair world. And, you know, I'm always going to be a little bit suspicious of perhaps some deeper philosophical motivations behind that. It's not just a pragmatic argument of functionality and what would work best. But a basket of currencies, you know, I think the significant shift here is that you've got academics like Barry Eichengreen arguing for the demise of the dollar from a positive standpoint. Now you've got policymakers standing up to cry foul that the monetary system, you know, the system incumbent, which is us since Bretton Woods. And I mean, of course, it differs in many respects from the post-war system, but it's still anchored on one currency. It's anchored on the U.S. dollar.
You know, you introduced me to Thomas Kuhn and just how long it takes a scientific revolution to occur. Now, when you've got a paradigm, when you've looked at the solar system, let's say, as something that circles the Earth for a long time, your mind gets set that way. And you get somebody out like Copernicus, you know, and he says, no, I think that it actually circles the sun. Well, that can get you killed. Okay, so regime change. We're talking about regime change. Can it happen quickly? Does it happen slowly?
It's a challenge, and Kuhn would say it takes a long time, and then it happens all at once.
Hmm.
I mean, so it's a gradual process and then very sudden. And there are violent aspects to regime change, and the most violent are when the old regime realizes they're on their way out, and there's a fight for survival. You know, that happens in academia, that happens in politics. I was only too pleased to see the former leader of Zimbabwe passed away in the last couple of weeks. He'd be a classic case in point. Anytime there was opposition against Robert Mugabe, you would just start seeing the body count increase.
Right.
And so in real terms, when there's a challenge to the regime, the costs go up. I don't know at what juncture regime change becomes a real issue with the U.S. dollar. If you look at the environment we're in now, it seems that as the global economy, and if the global economy continues to suffer, that reinforces dollar incumbency in the global monetary system. And I think this is one key reason I would not bet against the dollar in the years ahead. In a world of relative valuation, the dollar may be a big loser, but still a winner compared to the rest.
Is this why you don't try to bet one way or another? You just buy gold?
Right. I'd rather own gold than short the dollar. And here again, we have the gold story. Over time, the price of gold reflects the strengthening or weakening of your dominant currencies. So at times, the dollar buys more gold when the dollar's strong, or less gold when the dollar is weak. And we don't recognize dollar weakness in absolute terms because of this whole relative strength issue. We compare ourselves to the euros. Right now, we're stronger than the euro. You know, or the euro has been weakening in recent years. The pound sterling has been weakening in recent years. The Indian rupee weakening in recent years. Gold tells the real story of the big currencies. Gold and yen, perfect example. Gold in yen terms is already at all-time highs. It's already at all-time highs. We'll see that reflected in euro terms. We'll see that reflected in dollars shortly.
Yeah.
Is that 12 months? Is that 36 months? Don't know.
Does it really matter, though, if we're playing the long game? You know, we talked about your race. If you would have paced, okay, maybe you didn't have the fastest swim, but maybe it was a minute less than what you put out. And let's say on the bike, maybe you didn't pedal as hard as you were descending, but maybe rested a little bit.
Right.
The long game is so important. Your run probably would have gained by you actually focusing down the road instead of just in the moment.
Yeah, what if I said, I need gold to be at a certain price by 2025 because that's when I'm going to retire.
Right. And people do that.
They do. And now all of a sudden you take what is a long-term trend and you're trying to force, you know, this X factor in, which is your arbitrary retirement date. Could be 2021, could be 2019. you know, again, you're changing the variables. And I think the short term versus long term, there's too many things in play today that can shift the equation, shift the conversation, shift the outcome in the short run. Our concerns are long term concerns. But in the short term, you've got issues of trade and tariffs with China. You've got China who, you know, they may be very well at the turning of a tide. Who knows? If you take a long-term perspective, we may be passing the monetary regime baton to the Chinese. Not in the next 3 to 5 years. But I mean, listen, if you tune into Xi Jinping's admonition to the Politburo here recently, he says, guys, we need to be preparing for a long struggle. We won't be through this. And again, he's not thinking of just trade and tariffs, but he's thinking about the trajectory of China. We're not through our struggle to get to our appropriate destination till 2049.
Now, think that through for a second, Dave, because I've been here 32 years, and I knew your dad at the age that you are right now, okay? You will be about the age that your dad is now. Your dad's, what, 79?
He's 70.
Yeah. Okay,
yeah.
You'd be 70, what, 5?
Yeah, exactly. 2049. I'll be on the eve of my 75th birthday.
Right.
You'll have over 100 years since the institution of the Bretton Woods program. Maybe at that point, perhaps finally the Chinese will have moved away from their mercantilist model of growth and shifted to internal consumption and a service-oriented economy. You know, and I think reasonably, if their percentage of global GDP has at some point between now and 2049 surpassed ours, again, total contribution to global GDP, if theirs is larger than ours, then guess what? The evolution of the international monetary system will be away from dollars.
Right.
And perhaps it's not with the violence that regime change implies, but perhaps it's a more gradual evolutionary path. This is, again, long game, short game. Long term matters to me. You know, I'm grateful to have a little vacation time. It was wonderful, wonderful time with family. Great time with my mom and dad who live out in the Philippines. And we get to see them once a year, and this is it. But I'm pacing now with those time frames in mind. I mean, you know, 2049 sounds like a long time from now. But the way you play the game, the way you play the game is predicated on what your time frames are. Mine are with the next 30 years in mind. Not with the next 30 days or 30 seconds or whatever. I guess when we factor in where we're at as a country and the context of how we price all of our assets for the dollar, what course is it on? Is this the last chapter? And is it characterized by bang? Again, a la violent regime change or a whimper where the evolutionary process just leads us towards greater and greater irrelevance? Time will tell.
You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com. That's McIlvaney.com. And you can call us at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.